Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
I'm Marco Werman, co-host of The World. We're dropping a special series into our feed today. It's about the Kurdish community in Nashville, the largest in the U.S. The show, The Country in Our Hearts, tells the story of how that came to be. It's from WPLN, Nashville Public Radio. Host and reporter Rose Gilbert takes you on a journey from Nashville all the way to northern Iraq and back again, tracing the story of one Kurdish family and their generations-long fight to exist. It's four episodes. This is episode two.
And this is the older village, right here. This is where they would live. Like, you see the sign, welcome to Chalke.
I'm with Iran and his big, heavy SUV, perfect for rough mountain roads. We've arrived in the village of Chalke, the place that Iran and Nash's family fled so many years ago. As we drive down a steep gravel path lined with lush flowering bushes and tangled vines, he points out a fenced-off piece of land.
So behind here is our plot, too. This was where Grandpa kept a bunch of apples. Grape, apple, and walnuts were there, I remember. Because even when my dad was alive, he took good care of it.
He tells me that even after the village was abandoned for good in 1988, people kept coming back here to tend to the land. As the area got safer, it became a gathering spot for picnics and celebrations. Now, Iran takes stock of the land, pointing out fallen branches, orchards choked with undergrowth, walking paths lost to brambles and long grass. To me, it looks pretty, if a little overgrown. But it certainly isn't how Iran remembers it.
Oh, then it was very, it was all tidy, neat, you know, everywhere was clean. You wouldn't see extra twigs and all of that. Like, you wouldn't see this mess. I mean, 4 years of not touching it. What do you expect, you know?
4 years of this place growing wild, with no one allowed in to weed or water or plant or harvest. Because for years, this place was a war zone. Chalke sits near the border between Iraq and Turkey. That means it often gets caught up in clashes between the Turkish military and the PKK, a Kurdish militant group that's been at war with the Turkish government for decades. A few years ago, the Turkish military went after the PKK, invading this corner of Iraqi Kurdistan and turning Chalke into a battleground. This is the first year anyone has been allowed back.
Info. Hello, family.
Just down the road, a happy surprise.
Hello.
Oh, hi.
Hey.
Oh my God.
A gaggle of cousins, uncles, aunts, little nieces and nephews.
Hello. Rumi.
Members of Iran's family here from Nashville. They visit Kurdistan when they can, but it's a long, expensive trip.
What's up, buddy?
So Iran hasn't seen some of them in years.
You remember me?
They carry armfuls of fruit plucked from surrounding trees, still yielding despite 4 years of neglect.
Did you have any fresh food here? Yeah. I tried, it wasn't much.
A pair of Iran's great aunts show me how to crack open a pomegranate on a stone curb.
Oh.
Sitting in the sunshine, eating pomegranate seeds, and watching this far-flung family catch up, I'm struck by how much this small bit of land means to them. It's an inheritance passed down generation after generation. We eat our fill of fruit, then go wash our hands in the small stream that runs through the old village.
So, and this water comes obviously from somewhere up this mountain.
Adon stoops to drink a small handful of water and wash his face with careful, practiced motions. It's a small ritual he completes every time he comes here. After we wash up, I follow Iran into the trees.
I know we're in the vicinity.
Any path that was here has long since disappeared, and burrs and thorns catch on our clothes as we go. But after a short walk, we come across the ruins of a cottage. It's crumbled and covered in moss. And then there's another, remains of the old village. Aran points up ahead to a small pile of stones at the peak of the hill. That, he tells me, used to be his grandfather's home.
So maybe built in the 50s or 60s?
Yeah, just about, I would say.
So things really, you know, it's not an ancient ruin, it's a recent ruin.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. I wish it was much cleaner. You'll be able to just wander about. But see, this connects with that one down there. And then our land is right above a creek. So it's very... And this area was very good because it was resourceful. Water. Caves. Right? So in times, whenever there would be, let's say, a military operation with the bats, before the fleeing, people would just gather into the caves. Right? Or it's always good to have water close to you in times of that. So this place was very... This is why they didn't want to let go of it so soon.
Water for the farmland, caves for the people.
Exactly.
We stay there a while, staring at the cairn of stones where Adon's grandfather used to live. Illuminated by the late afternoon sunshine, it seems to float above the overgrown village, suspended along a horizon of soaring mountains.
It's beautiful.
I'm spending the next few days here, in Chalke. Aran is taking me on a journey, a retracing of sorts, from crumbling ruins to intimate family dinners and through narrow mountain passes. We're taking a journey into this land, a land for which so much blood has been spilled, a land this family thought they had lost forever. But also, I'm going to take you into the history of this family and the burdens carried by each generation, the burden of what they lost and the burden of salvaging what's left. I'm Rose Gilbert, and from Nashville Public Radio, you're listening to The Country in Our Hearts. This is Episode 2, The Ones Who Face Death. Old Chalke, the place Aran and Nash's family once fled. The people do still live here, just a few miles down the road, actually, in a village built by the survivors of Saddam Hussein's all-on-fall campaign, a place they call New Chalke. That's where Aran and I are headed.
So what are you dropping off now?
First, though, we're stopping to drop off some passports and visa paperwork at an aunt's house.
Oh, it was just some paperwork. I forgot to hand it to her. She has to get done. It'll just be a quick drop off.
Oh, yeah.
Have you had breakfast? You're not hungry?
We slip off our shoes at the door and head inside to enjoy a hearty breakfast spread. Fruit, cheese, yogurt, lavash bread, and small tender cuts of lamb. Aran and I aren't the only visitors either. The house is full of more family who also happen to be in town from Nashville, including Aran's aunt Falvzia, his father's sister. She joins us for breakfast, taking a seat next to me. As we eat, she begins to tell me about her brother, Aran's father. During the time I'd spent with Nash and Aran, I had started to get a picture of their father, the Peshmerga commander, the warrior, the larger-than-life patriarch. But Falvzia knew him first as her big brother Naif. She remembers the day he snuck off to join the Peshmerga. He was only about 13 years old.
I remember vividly. They went to him and it was another villager. They both joined at the same time. They heard that there was Peshmerga forces in Qumri, so they went, obviously, sneakfully. She's like, but I was the first one to know, and I gave the news to my parents. And that was the reaction she did. She said, that's the reaction my grandma, her mom, did.
Mimicking her mother's panic, she claps her palms to her cheeks and buries her face in her hands.
She goes, oh my God, okay, so now I can just label my son dead. She's like, her mom was like, oh my God, so now I can just consider him a martyr. You know.
He came home after enlisting with a big rifle on his back.
She's like, half of the muzzle, like, not half, but about an inch or two of the muzzle, you would see it had dirt in it from dragging it on the walk. But she's like, and then we all just started crying.
Naif begged his parents for forgiveness, again and again. But he didn't regret joining.
She said he told his mom, he was like, Mom, if I don't, and the next person, and the next person, then we won't ever have a Kurdish identity.
While reporting on Nashville's Kurdish community, just about everyone I met had a father or uncle or brother who had been in the Peshmerga, or they'd been a fighter themselves. Some had joined as teenagers, but 13 still stuck out to me as young. After signing up, Naif was gone for months at a time, off in the mountains fighting for the Kurdish cause, with only the occasional letter to his family. When he could visit, it was a huge relief and a cause for celebration. And then he would leave again.
Whenever he would leave, she said we wouldn't clean the house for a day or two. Because, you know, it was kind of like a farewell. We didn't know if he would come back. And she said there'll be days sometime, a day or two sometime, we wouldn't even eat. Because all we were, everybody was worried and crying. Because one, young, and two, he's in the Peshmerga. Which, I mean, the definition in front of death, you know?
The word Peshmerga translates roughly to one who faces death. They are mythic, heroic figures in Kurdish culture. Underdog warriors fighting for freedom against bigger, stronger opponents. Favzia tells me that when any Peshmerga came to town, they were welcomed as heroes. Villagers risked the wrath of the Ba'athist regime to feed and shelter them as best they could.
She said, if you own one chicken, if you knew the Peshmerga were coming, she said that day they would make sure to slaughter that chicken and cook it for them because they knew the hardship that they were going. They knew they were in the mountains. They didn't enjoy a good hot meal.
And if it wasn't safe to come out into the open, the local women would smuggle provisions to the fighters in their mountain hideouts. Stuff that was easy to carry, like dried yogurt, rice, the thin lavash bread we ate for breakfast. Favzia says the Iraqi soldiers stationed in the region caught on pretty quickly, but many of them let it happen anyway. She remembers two guards in particular were especially lenient.
They were very, very generous. And she said a lot of times they would even, when they were out on lookout, they would turn their eye when the Peshmerga would come into town.
Naif joined the Peshmerga as a young teenager and fought in the Iraq-Kurdish wars of the 60s and 70s. He rose through the ranks rapidly, from a regular fighter all the way to a general. The life of a Peshmerga required sacrifice. Naif sustained serious gunshot and shrapnel injuries 7 separate times, at least one of which required hospitalization in Iran. When Naif got married and started a family, they were constantly on the run from the Iraqi military. And when his children and wife came to America, he didn't go with them. Instead, he stayed behind to fight in a brewing civil war. So Aran and Nash grew up with a faraway hero for a father. Aran only knew his face from a photo his mother had given him when he was very little.
She said you carried it with you. It was with you 24/7. She's like, and when we decided to take it away from you, threw up such a big fit that, you know, we had to bring your picture back.
Naif visited the family in America for the first time when Aran was 3 years old. Now, Aran pulls out his phone to show me a photo of the moment they reunited at the airport.
Yeah, that's me and my father right here. And this is the first time he came to America. This was 1993.
Aran's father is wearing a khaki uniform and a camouflage field jacket. He has a traditional turban and a thick mustache. He's smiling at a 3-year-old Aran, who stares back at him, transfixed.
So she's like, that's why you were staring. You're like, that's the man in the photo that I've been carrying around this whole time.
Years after Naif's first trip to America, Aran went to visit him in Iraq. It was his first time in Kurdistan, and a lot of that trip was spent on the road. As they drove, Aran says that Naif would point out the places he'd fought battles, historic landmarks, and villages their family had lived in before Aran was born.
That was our time to chit-chat, because whenever we would get to the destination, people would flood.
Aran tells me the drive to the village always makes him think of visiting his father.
You know, People would come around. Now it was their time. So mine and his, our time was mostly the car ride.
After breakfast, the paperwork is sorted out and Aran and I get back in the car. On the drive to Nuchalke, he tells me more about that first trip to Kurdistan. Naif was a prominent member of his tribe, and that meant his time was always in high demand. With little Aran at his side, he attended weddings and funerals, presided over land deals, and helped resolve disagreements of all sorts.
He used to say, God bless me and put me in this position, so it's my duty to go, serve my people. I mean, you know, it was his role.
It's a role that Aran has inherited. Despite growing up pretty much entirely in America, he is the only one of his brothers or sisters living in Kurdistan.
Yeah, I take pride in it, right? At times I feel like kind of like a pressure, because now you're in both worlds.
In 2013, Aran's father died from a heart attack, and Aran made the decision to move to Kurdistan. He felt a responsibility to preserve his father's legacy, the legacy he'd fought and bled for. This is his family's land, but it's not where he grew up. Aran still feels very American.
But, you know, I'm very open-minded, Western-minded, and then you come here. But still, you still feel that kind of gap. You know, all I remember is America growing up.
Today, though, Aran's the one who spends his time on the road, always headed to some invitation or appointment, constantly taking calls from people in Kurdistan and America alike. Friends and family who have questions, problems, or are just looking to stay connected.
I have that, I won't say it's a burden, but I have that pressure on me too, to where I have to attend. Because like I'm here, you know, I'm his only son here. And it's very cultural, you know. So, but I've grown into that. And I got that from him.
Aran is not the only one who has felt called to return to these mountains. There are others of his generation, members of his own family, who have come back to live in and rebuild their father's homeland. As it turns out, Chalke is a difficult place to leave behind, even for the ones too young to remember leaving in the first place. More after the break. Nuchalke is just a few miles away from the old village we visited earlier. It sits further down in the valley than Old Chalke, on a flattish stretch of land right on the main road. The homes are mostly pale stucco with walled gardens. Aran tells me that much of the village was built in the 90s with money sent back from relatives in Nashville. This time of year, it's bursting with green. Roses and sunflowers, trellises of grapes, trees heavy with figs and pomegranates. Kids ride bikes and chase each other through the dusty streets. We drive with the windows down, and Aran keeps spotting people he knows and stopping to talk.
There goes Zozo.
Zozan is one of Aran's cousins on his father's side of the family.
Hi, I'm Zozan.
Rose, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Sorry.
She wears sunglasses and a printed cotton house dress, floor length and traditional. Like Aran, Zozan grew up in Tennessee. That's where she met and married her husband, whose family is also from Chalke. And that's not as much of a coincidence as you might think. After fleeing in 1988, dozens of families from this one little village ended up in Nashville.
That's my husband, Zindan.
She was with us at Jessica.
Good, how are you?
I'm Zindan.
Rose, nice to meet you.
Hey, Rose, nice to meet you.
After the COVID-19 pandemic, they packed up their lives and their three little daughters and moved back to Kurdistan, looking for a slower, groovier, more traditional pace of life. Zozan is a homemaker, and her husband works remotely, running a taxi company back in Nashville. They're building a house of their own, but for now they're living in her grandfather-in-law's empty home.
You want to tour our house?
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah, we'll tour our house.
It's pretty bare bones. There's little furniture besides a handful of sleeping mats, shrouded in mosquito netting, and no hot running water. Still, Zozan loves it here.
It's very peaceful. Like I said, the idea of moving here was just to pause and enjoy our children, like enjoy life.
She spends her days homeschooling her kids and tending to the garden.
Here, I feel like we just wake up in the morning, have a cup of coffee. It takes about an hour, 2 hours for the kids to wake up, and then we do our homeschool. It's very relaxed here.
As we talk, Zozan makes bundles of holy basil tied with twine and shows me which figs are ripe enough to eat. One of her daughters teaches me how to crack open and peel fresh walnuts, which stains the tips of our fingers a deep brown.
No, you got, if you eat this part, it's dead.
If you eat the skin, it's definitely bitter.
I'm lucky. It's harvest season, which means I'm here just in time to sample some of the best fresh fruits, greens, and nuts this part of the world has to offer. Foods that have grown here for centuries, picked and eaten by generations of this family. As the sun sets, the mountains turn pink and gold all around us, and soon it's time for dinner. We eat on the floor, sitting on a carpet with a sheet of plastic over it to keep everything tidy. Dishes of chickpeas, chicken, lamb, and rice are set out family style, alongside plenty of bread and fresh greens. Seated across from me is Zozan's father, Ayub. His face is clean-shaven and lined from years of working in the sun. He wears a checked dress shirt and a tightly folded turban. As we eat, I realize Ayub is the uncle Nash talked about when he told me the story of how they fled in 1988. The uncle who came to warn them, who told them they needed to leave. Now, Ayub tells me the full story, with his daughter Zozan translating. And it follows the same basic rhythm as Nash's story. The army came, they had to run. But in Ayub's telling, I hear something else. Memories, lost along the way from Chalke to Nashville. And a silence between these two generations. It was the summer of 1988, and Ayub had a heavy responsibility on his shoulders. He was the eldest of three brothers. The other two, including Adan's father, were away, fighting for the Peshmerga.
Brothers entrusted him with the family, with their own families, and then especially his mom and dad.
In his brother's absence, it was Ayub's responsibility to care for their land, their animals, their aging parents, and their wives and children. It was a tense time. Remember, Iraq was at war with Iran, and now the Iraqi army was gassing entire Kurdish villages. They'd done it to Halabja, and now people feared they were coming for Chalke.
So when they heard the news of Halabja, shortly after, a month after, 2 months after, everyone started to fleeing. There was no, like, if you had a way, you would leave.
Ayub and his family hung on for weeks after everyone else was gone. Then, one summer morning, Ayub was climbing a mountain outside the village, when he saw them.
Oh, wow, from all the way from over there, Chelkaseri. Yeah. So he saw from binocular how many soldiers were lined up here. There was tanks, soldiers, all preparing to come that way towards the Chalke village.
The Iraqi army had set up camp here, on the stretch of land where we were now sitting.
So from this whole section, there was no homes here. Then, so it was all tents lined up, and then their tanks.
A few soldiers spotted him looking and called out to him.
They yelled, there's an anfal, so if you do not leave your towns, you will be gassed. Chemical gases.
Ayub went back to Chalke and gathered everyone as quickly as he could. This is the part Nash told me about.
Okay, so so they started walking by foot with children, his two parents, they were both of old age, mother and father. The children were, God, I was 3 years old, Dad.
Hashti.
Yeah, so he had two to three babies on his back, so carrying in a little baby carrier. Then he also had his rifle.
About 15, 16 kids in total, he says, nearly all under the age of 10.
Oh, man. So all those children, imagine all those children.
She sounds surprised.
Do you have any memory of this?
I only have memory. I have a very, very, my, I have a very, very small memory of this, but I clearly remember seeing, hearing bombs, blood. I remember seeing, because I was 3 years old. So I do remember some of it.
The Iraqi army had been in the area for weeks, and so the family had known they'd need to leave soon. They had prepared by stashing rugs and blankets and other essentials in the mountains near the spring that fed their village. When it came time to run, the family met at the stream, the same place where Aran had washed his face earlier today. They followed it up to its source, the spring.
And then they fled from where you went today, by that water, the river, and then Shwerehin Chun and Piochun. So they went all by foot. So he'll take you there tomorrow.
The walk was slow and exhausting, with Ayub at the back to make sure no one was left behind. But they made it to the mountains, to the Turkish border, and to relative safety. They camped there overnight. In the morning, they woke to the sound of explosions echoing through the mountains. The Iraqi army had started bombing neighboring villages with chemical weapons.
Once they left, once they heard the bombs, there was no turning back.
Ayub begins to tell the next part of the story. I turn to Zozan to translate, but find her staring at her father, her eyes suddenly full of tears.
So he had said, so this is emotional for me. So my nov jashar, what you know, Gutawa? So the Iraqi were, you know, the Iraqi were patrolling the mountains. Oh, wow. So mind you, a couple of nights before they fled, my dad knew. He said, we knew that we would never come back here.
When they fled, Ayub's wife realized they had left behind something important, a hand-carved cradle. So he and a friend took a mule and snuck back down through the mountains to Chalkir.
So he had to come back for the cradle, and then while he was here, he said there was some food, that some crops that he had taken for the family.
Zozan is crying quietly now, and it seems like a struggle to keep talking.
And a bag of clothes, and then just so they came to get those stuff, so that night they had gone the same night.
I tell her we can stop if she needs to, but she waves me off, determined to keep going.
Yeah, it's okay. No, it's okay.
Whose cradle was it?
It was my brother, who, his name is Talon. He recently passed away, actually.
Sorry yeah. for your loss.
It's okay. Yeah.
Please, like, really, at any time.
No. This is actually good. I've never heard it. I've never heard it in this detail. Have you, Oran? No, I haven't either. Yeah. Go ahead.
It struck me that Zozan didn't know exactly what had happened all those years ago. She'd lived through it, but growing up, she tells me her parents didn't want to talk about it. No one wanted to revisit these memories or put that burden on their children. But Ayub is talking about it now, stoically retelling the details of this terrible day. That only changes as he starts to tell me about his brother, Aran's dad.
He said he loved his brother more than his own self. Brothers can be replaced. I now know your pain, Dad. Just to be bra, Nina. Yep. Inshallah, he's in a better place. Inshallah.
I realized I'd become a witness to an intense moment of connection here. A father digging out painful details of the family history, and a daughter reaching out to reclaim them. And just like that, the moment ends.
A lot of amazing memories, and he is, you could see he's very emotional at this moment. But
thank you so much.
Thank you very much for sharing.
All right, thank you.
He's telling me he's done talking.
I'm sure he has so much to tell, but I think this was so, you know, kind of impromptu for him. He was, you know, very like,
no,
I'm sure he could go on for hours. Yeah.
We all kind of go quiet for a moment, listening to the crickets singing outside and the kids playing in the next room. More than 30 years ago, Ayub evacuated his entire family from this place, the threat of Halabja ringing in his ears. Now, he was visiting his daughter and her family, who have come back to Kurdistan to build their lives on the same bit of land where Iraqi soldiers once told Ayub they were going to bomb him.
He feels a sense of freedom of being in your own land. He enjoys the kids being here because he knows that this is their home, this is my home, this is their father's home, and that they're able to speak their mother tongue without being scared.
After my conversation with Zozan and Ayub, it's late, but the night is far from over. I chat with Haylin, the youngest daughter of Aran's aunt Fawzia. She's in her late 20s, with long, carefully straightened hair and big hazel eyes.
You don't pass up on my aunt's tea, because she makes the most amazing tea in the village.
It's rare to have so much of the family together in the village, reunited from across oceans. And so they stay up late to soak in every minute of it. They catch up over tea and cigarettes. A few older women bring out endless trays of sunflower seeds and tiny pastries filled with jam and fresh walnuts, plucked from the same trees we visited earlier. This hospitality is a familiar ritual, something these ladies learned from their mothers and aunts and grandmothers, something they're determined to pass on to their children and grandchildren. The family stays up like that for hours, just enjoying each other's company. I can't keep up, and I'm eventually sent to bed sometime around 2 in the morning.
Good night.
I bunk with Haylin and one of her cousins. We sleep side by side on thick mats called dusheks. Haylin explains that, at first, the family wanted to give me my own room.
But I was like, no, I want to give her that whole vibe of when you visit Kurdistan, you visit your family's home, and you all sleep in the room together. And, you know, you're sleeping on the dusheks on the floor. There's a whole, like, nostalgia that comes with that as well.
Chalke is a place for nostalgia, a touchstone for this family and so many others, a place people travel across oceans to get back to where they can touch the land, eat the fruits, sleep side by side on dusheks, small rituals that piece together what was destroyed so many years ago. The house finally falls silent, except for the sound of crickets and jackals outside. I fall asleep thinking of guns and cradles and pomegranates. In the morning, Aran is waiting outside with his car to show me the place where Ayub took their families that terrible day in 1988. I've heard the story of this family's escape through the mountains, from Nash and now Ayub. Today, we're retracing their steps. Haylin has decided to join us for an uphill hike. So we set off, passing through the old village, keeping on until we reach a town called Hirure.
Sound of the beautiful water, greenery, pomegranates everywhere. The village is waking up, right? I bet they're all inside cooking some breakfast.
We start by the stream, the same stream that feeds Chalke. It's a postcard of a place, all waterfalls and green woods, and recently it's become something of a tourist destination. They've put in a gravel pathway and a few sets of stairs. Even with these modern conveniences, we start to lose our breath pretty quickly. I try to imagine what it was like before, for Ayub, hiking this trail with three children and a gun on his back. And then for 12-year-old Nash, carrying his little sister to safety. As we keep going, the path narrows and the trees start to thin out. We're really in the mountains now, with sheer cliffs rising on either side of us. If we keep going, we'll be in Turkey.
It seems like a gateway, a door up. I guess that's the way I picture it.
Today, this is a scenic hiking path. But in 1988, it was the path to safety.
It makes you realize, like, we have endured a lot. right? And I guess me, so the decision for me to come back here and help with either way I can makes it mean something for me. This is how we got here. This is the backstory. So it means something. It's history, right? You have to hold on to it, either good or bad.
After about 30 minutes, we come across a rocky overhang in one of the cliff sides, just high enough off the ground for someone to sit underneath. This is where the family camped overnight and where they heard the chemical bombs drop the next morning.
And you know, remember, especially in mountainous areas at night, sound travels, right? So that's probably something, a sense where like, hey, shh, you hear that in the distance.
Just a few steps later, we're there, the source of the stream, the place the families met before crossing the border to Turkey. This is where the path ends. Haleen and I leave our shoes on the side and dip our tired feet in the ice-cold water, the same water that flows down to Old Çalke, to the new village where Zozan and her family live. At one point, a herd of sheep and goats appear from the mountains, along with their shepherd, an older man who wears a Kurdish suit and a baseball cap. He stops to talk to Adan, asking him what tribe he's from and who his parents are. Sure enough, he knows the family, which Haleen says is pretty typical. Everyone knowing everyone. That was how life was for her parents' generation here.
You just have to understand, they grew up together in all aspects of their life. You know, they were in the villages together, they washed their clothes together, they showered together, they went to get milk together, and then the war came and they ran for their lives together. They had to survive together with their kids on their back. And then they're in this refugee camp, and it's sad times, but they're together. And then when we were refugees and to America, that's, again, together. It's all about the togetherness for them. Again, they had to survive, as Kurds always do.
They survived and came to Nashville, Tennessee. But Nashville is a lot bigger than Çalke. You can't know everyone there. That togetherness was splintered irreversibly when these families fled. It's something they come back here, to Kurdistan, to try and reclaim by visiting their old orchards and staying up all night talking. It's why Haleen and Fawzia and Ayub come here all the way from Nashville. It's the reason why the cousins who work and go to school in Zaho or Duhuk still live here during summers and on weekends. It's why Adan is building a home of his own here, on top of a hill on the outskirts of the new village. It's still a work in progress, but I can already tell it will stick out as impressive. Two stories tall, with big terraces, a swimming pool, and sweeping views of the valley. Adan shows me around the garden, which is dotted with frail, freshly planted saplings. Pomegranate trees that Adan brought all the way from Halabja. I ask him why he's building this house. After all, he spends a lot of his time in the city or on the road, and he already has relatives he can stay with when he wants to visit the village.
It's home. You know, at the end of the day, like, whoever comes back, my whole family's in the West, obviously, but whenever they come, they like to be close to here. And it's like, I guess to keep my family's, I want to just say legacy, but to keep, you know, my father's home, his door open.
Preserving his family's legacy in Çalke, keeping his father's door open. This is the responsibility that Adan has taken on by coming back to Kurdistan. A responsibility he's fulfilling by building this monument of a home on a hill. Standing at the edge of his unfinished swimming pool, looking out at Çalke below, I think about the life Adan left behind in Nashville. His mother, his brothers and sisters, his friends, the place he grew up. Adan came to Kurdistan out of responsibility to his family and to his father. But that's not the only reason he left Nashville. He left Nashville because he was trying to get away from something. He was trying to get away from trouble. Next on The Country in Our Hearts, Episode 3, Safety Zone. The Country in Our Hearts was reported and produced by me, Rose Gilbert. My editor and co-producer was Mariba Knight. Additional editing by Tony Gonzalez, LaTanya Turner, and Rachel Yacovone, with help from Mariana Bacayao, Char Dastin, and Justin Barney. Mac Limbaugh is Nashville Public Radio's Vice President of Audience and supported this project in many ways. Our community and cultural advisors on this project were Dr. Dave Romano and Dilman Yassin. Sound design was done by Martine Cruz, fact-checking by Daniel Potter, and original logo artwork by Nuveen Barwari. Traditional music was by Arkan Doski, with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Paul McAdoo, Jennifer Nelson, and to the village of Chalke and the people there who showed me so much hospitality. The Country in Our Hearts was made possible by the financial support of Nashville Public Radio listeners and special contributions by members Jackie Schrago, Fletcher Burton, and William D. Kenner, M.D. Travel was funded in part by the Overseas Press Club, and the project received an important grant from Humanities Tennessee, an independent affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The findings and conclusions of this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of Humanities Tennessee or of the National Endowment for the Humanities.